Still Queer as Folk. Michael discovers Brazilian beach butt parasites. And Justin gets handsy with a football player. This episode is called Ted's Not Dead, Season 1, Episode 4.
It first aired on Showtime in the U.S. on December 17th, 2000.
It was written by Richard Kramer and directed by Kevin Inch, also based on the UK series. This is the first episode not written by showrunners Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman. Richard Kramer wrote 12 episodes of 30-something. He produced 8 episodes of My So-Called Life. Love that show. He's currently producing the ABC show Nashville, so this guy's a heavyweight in drama. I was really looking forward to this episode, but we'll see how it goes.
So Kevin Inch has been directing television since the 80s. He did 11 episodes of Beverly Hills 90210.
So we've got
the soap opera going on. 22 episodes of Sisters, and eventually 8 episodes of Queer as Folk. So we have another heavyweight coming in very early in season 1. To get you into what Ted's Not Dead is about, while Ted lies in a drug-induced coma, Brian learns that he is named the executor of Ted's living will. Also, Justin's mother suspects the truth about her son's sexuality.
Oh, Jennifer.
This is the soap opera drama.
Yeah, it's the drama episode. So we pick up this episode in the diner. Looks like the morning after, and the guys are comparing notes.
Yes, we're basically receiving play-by-play of how everyone's night went after they left Babylon.
Oh, yeah. This was another voiceover from Michael, wasn't it?
I don't think it was a voiceover. It was more like everyone kind of got their own telling of the events, you know?
So Did he start out with, who said the line of Babylon was to die for?
In case you weren't there, I got to tell you, last Saturday night at Babylon was to die for.
I just remember that line's just stuck right out. Because he was telling the story of the gay water polo captain that worked with emotionally disturbed children.
And somehow, like, he was still okay. Like he was being turned on by this description of all the things that this water polo guy did. Like, there's got to be a point in when it's like, don't talk.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because Michael gets this guy home, but Michael always seems like the guy that's never bringing anybody home as much as Ted is, though.
That's true. I think, it's because Michael is so preoccupied with having to take care of Brian in some regard. Like, that's what we're seeing in all these episodes. Every time, there's this possibility for Michael, Brian's doing something, and so Michael feels it's his duty to step in. And it's like, no, that's just a cover, because, of course, you're still in love with Brian.
And unfortunately, his trick had Brazilian butt parasites.
He had them. Brazilian beach parasites in his ass.
I'm trying to. It was almost like a casual nature in which he brought that up.
Yeah, because Michael says something like, "You're really well rounded." All of a sudden, he just drops it.
And Michael's like ready to just go to town on this boy. And I'm like, I am super glad he started with the front and not the back at that moment.
Did he kick him out after that? I think it just.
We don't
left
know.
That scene, and we never really found out.
For all intents and purposes, it's possible that Michael's like, I'm going to muscle through it.
Meanwhile, Emmett's in a dungeon with his dungeon master, who is, as we find out, is an undertaker.
Here's the thing about that like cutaway is that it felt so casual. I'm like, I have a lot of friends in the kink community. And so,
I thought you were going to say the undertaker community.
I have nothing else. So to see how casual it was for Emmett to be in all of this gear, and then as if they had something in a larger size, I'm like,
do you have this in a size larger?
First of all, that's not the point of the gear you're wearing. And I love when the Undertaker says, we need to get this going. I have a couple in the morning or something like that.
Yeah.
And he's like, what, you're bi? It's like, oh no, they die in a car crash or something. I was like, is that some sort of like breach of privacy? The Undertakers have to describe this, something like that.
This scene, as you know, I'm a huge fan of the UK version of Queer as Folk. Mm-hmm. And this scene was just a few seconds out of a much bigger scene in the UK edition.
And realize, Patrick, you only get 3 mentions of the UK version per episode.
That's
and,
right.
And you're literally within the first 2 minutes, you used 1. So let's choose this wisely.
I think I used 2. I think when I was introing the episode, I used my first one. So I guess I've got 1 left. So there was that cute scene also when they're talking about what went on last Saturday at Babylon, where Brian says, "I made it an early evening," and then there's a quick cut to Justin naked on Brian's bed. I wish that they would have done more with that scene, but more important things to come in this episode. So we just get that quick look at Brian's ass, Justin naked on the bed, and boom, that's it.
And, you know, they're laughing and chuckling about it, and then we have Debbie coming in, who's waiting on them at their table, and just really cuts the mood.
Yeah.
Says, "Don't you have a friend in the hospital?" Or something to that effect. And it's like, oh, we bring in the weight of the episode. Whereas I think the last episode, the Briss episode, was very, very comedic, very slapstick, very almost sitcom-y.
Screwball comedy is what I called it last week.
It was just wacky. Here we have, we're returning to what I think the series is overall really is a drama, no doubt. Mm-hmm. In part to, you know, we now don't have Russell Mulcahy directly involved,
right?
So
no more music videos.
No, we have 30 something happening. It's the gay 30 something.
Yeah, and especially when we took one look at Ted's mother. You know, she's in the back of the scene. The guys come in, they're asking the nurse if they can go visit Ted. And we see Ted's mother in the background, and she looks so naive and kind of cute, and you feel a little sorry for her because everybody can relate to that mother waiting in the hospital for her drug-addled son to come out of his coma.
That's so cold.
Too soon?
That's so cold. No, she's positively Midwestern. Like, I think if ever I were in a drug-induced coma, that's exactly how my mother would look. She would just be sitting there quietly, and she was. I mean, Ted's mother is very sweet to the boys when you know they ask if they can see him, and she says, if you need permission, I'll make sure you get it. Well, that's very sweet.
But then Michael just blurts out,
"He must have met someone that night, and took him home."
And it's like, who says that to a mother in that situation?
Right. I'm sorry, but in no way do parents, unless they're like the chillest of chill parents and you've built that relationship, would you ever want to discuss your sexual exploits with your parents? Or your friend's parents? No, thank you. Like, I'm not going to tell my mother what I did last night.
I mean, well, we know what you did last night.
Calm down, Patrick.
We have this funny sequence where Brian's checking out the hospital orderly. Nothing out of the norm there. But then Michael does this like shush to Brian to stop him from looking at the orderly. And I just thought that was just kind of meaningless.
Who's he
doing that for?
Well, Michael's
Mrs. Schmidt's benefit, who he just said, kind of graphic things about her son. I don't know why that line was there.
Well, I will say, I don't think Michael was necessarily being graphic. I think he was trying to choose his words carefully, saying that, like, he might have, instead of saying, he probably took this guy to hook up with him, he was just like, he probably met someone. Like, I like the fact he didn't even, he barely mentioned a gender too. You know, he's just like, he might have met someone and taken him home. And left a lot up to the imagination.
Yeah.
You know? So I think while he was trying to be gentle with Ted's mom, with Brian, because Brian's like, a cat in heat or something, like he smells the testosterone in the air and is like, oh, new target.
This was interleaved with that scene of Justin's mother rifling through his shit again. Well, she wakes him up, then sends him into the shower, I think, and then starts rifling through all of his stuff and finds that page of sketches.
Right. She finds it. Yeah. She goes through his sketchbook and sees all of the hunky football players. I mean, he looks like he's taken a lot of lessons from Tom of Finland, the way his sketches turn out.
But there's that one page where it looked like a middle school girl had just written her boyfriend's name over and over. So there's these wonderful pencil sketches, and then
Brian and all sorts of different fonts and bubble letters and shadowing. And I'm just like,
Where does artistic skills go? But the interesting thing is, in the first 3 minutes, we see three mothers together. And that was an interesting theme throughout this entire episode.
Right. And there are three mothers that are all in different different phases of accepting their children's lifestyle, if you will. You know, you have Debbie, who's like a P-flag walking
mom.
She's a walking P-flag sign.
Yep.
And you have Justin's mother, who is just kind of getting things confirmed for her. And then we have Ted's mother, who has quietly accepted it. But given how she responds to Michael, maybe there's still lingering feelings with how she feels about Ted being gay.
Mm-hmm.
When Michael does make his comment about that Ted may have taken someone home, she blatantly asks, you know, what if he had taken a girl home, would someone have left him on the floor? And I'm like, well, oh, that's...
Yes.
God, Patrick.
Well, and then we have Jennifer, Justin's mother, who... is not at all accepting. So we almost have like this low, medium, and high setting of mothers based on where they're at with their individual sons. And this was something in the writing that I liked. And for once, I mean, this is episode four, but for once, there was something very subtle that you really had to pay attention to, and you didn't have it spoon-fed to you the whole time. So props on the writing here.
Yeah, they definitely carry the theme throughout the episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they did. I think overall, and when we get to it, we'll go deeper into it. But we definitely see that they're able to tie in each layer throughout the episode. And I thought that was really great.
Yeah, there was something going on back at the hospital that was kind of weird when all the guys were standing there talking, and one of them says it was probably that Blake guy that Ted went home with, and I think maybe Emmett said, should we tell somebody? And Brian just mysteriously says, no.
Who do you think it was? I mean, who gave him the drugs?
I bet it was that guy Blake who was cruising him all night.
You think we should tell someone?
No.
Wouldn't you think at that time they would want to get some answers or like catch the guy or...
Right. Like, did they... there are a lot of unanswered questions. Was there a tox screen done? Do they know it was GHB in his system? Like, if you know the person that Ted went home with, you'd want to track the guy down.
Yeah, because
this
isn't one of their friends. This is like some stranger, and they just happen to know his name. It's not like somebody in their clique. So, I mean, why wouldn't you want to turn this guy in? Who's Brian protecting?
Yeah, they owe nothing to him. This episode really did something odd with the friend dynamic here, because they have a friend in the hospital, and yet they were still going out to Babylon.
Yeah, sure.
And they were still having like a great, as I mean, it's hard to think like, oh, hi, I have a friend who might be close to death. Excuse me while I try and go get some at the gay club again. Like,
yeah.
Is it so ingrained in their routine that that's all they can do?
Well, and I think that's why the mother's front and center on this really started to illustrate some of the selfish and reckless behavior that they might be into. And so it was a good way to parry the drinking, the partying, the drug taking with a down to earth, like family moment.
Yeah. Let's not forget the trail mix. So like they are pretty cavalier with their drug use.
Right.
So while they're waiting to see Ted, and I'm trying to remember how it was brought up, but we find out that Brian had sex with Ted. Sort of. That it was some beach orgy or something like that.
I didn't know the beach came into play.
I could have sworn I heard the phrase beach in there. I can't tell you for sure. But
I like the way Brian introduced the characters of that orgy.
Scott and Kevin, the Todds.
The Todds, the multiple Todds.
I think every group of gay guys always has like a list of the usual suspects that are kind of the go-tos for any particular orgy or anything.
If you're into this, you're going to want to call Todd number two. But if you're into this, you're going to want Todd number one.
Or just get the Todds.
Get the Todds if you're into one and two.
Did you see that little move that Emmett did when they were talking about this? And he, as soon as Brian said the Todds, Emmett flicks his little pinky out. It was like so subtle, and I backed it up, looked at it a couple times.
wait, what was it? Wait, what is he doing with his pinky?
Brian's introducing the cast of his orgy, Scott, Kevin, the Todds. Sure. And as soon as he says the Todds, Emmett just kind of puts his pinky out and wiggles it. It was so subtle, and it was so cute. And I like that it wasn't like a big meal out of Emmett saying that, you know, the Todds kind of aren't hung. I like that it was just this kind of little like flick, like, yeah, those guys. Very subtle, very cool, very cute. Loved it. Brian's giving this drug taking lecture. They're also like, never take drugs without your friends.
That's just common sense.
We know not to believe pretty little blonde boys who tell you that it's really good shit. Because that's what they all say. Ted didn't know that. And he didn't know that you only do drugs with your friends because they're the only ones that give a fuck about you.
That was something I talked about in the last episode. It's like, Ted, I love you, and I really want this Blake thing to happen, but you don't really know Blake. And you're going to take this clear liquid and just down it? Come on.
No.
I was like, no, I was very much wagging my finger at Ted for that.
I just thought that Brian was suddenly like very preachy because of all the risky things that Brian does. And I mean, you'll have a drink with like a stranger, right?
Oh, sure. But like,
do you have to make sure that it's a fresh bottle with the seal on it before you'd have a drink?
So, absolutely.
So what's the difference with your GHB? So that scene wraps up, and all of a sudden, there's a cutscene to Melanie just barreling into Brian's office. And
Melanie usually just barrels into a room.
I love how she gets so riled up.
Yeah.
Excuse me for barging in.
Like she, I picture her like outside his office, like pumping herself up, like I'm gonna get him, I'm gonna tear that motherfucker down, you know, like she's just getting herself ready so that when she walks in, she is at like 100 miles an hour, going like, here's the deal.
Did we know that she's a lawyer until this episode? I don't think we did.
So. I feel like we've been very vague in what Mel does. We know that apparently she can speak all Axis powers. We know that she obviously can provide for a family. You know, she and Lindsay have a very nice house. They now have a new baby. You know, they're able to do all these things. So
this was a recurring theme throughout the entire series. It seems that Melanie not only speaks all access powers, but she also practices every aspect of law that there is. No matter what the problem was, she practiced that kind of law.
Right. She's very much lawyer.
Yeah.
In the most generic sense of the word.
In air quotes.
Lawyer. So she bursts into Brian's office and lays out the paperwork in front of Brian saying that, so you're the executor. You have control over Ted's life.
Yeah.
And again, Ted, what the hell were you thinking? And why would you ever put Brian in charge of that?
And we find out.
Which, of course, you know, that was Brian's question. And I think this ties again back to the theme of mortality with Brian. And I think we see this in every episode. Here, I think this is like the one instance we get it, but they continue to carry it throughout. Mm-hmm. We have Mel blatantly asks, do you have a will? And he goes like, no. It's like he can't be bothered. He doesn't have the time. Again, in taking part in incredibly risky behaviors, but feels like he's going to live forever, you know? So, of course, he's not going to bother with a will. It won't matter.
Yeah, that's interesting you mentioned that because it seems like it's another hidden theme. Mm-hmm. You know, we had the mothers, first of all, and now we have this mortality theme where Ted's seen one end of mortality and we see that Brian is on an entirely different end of that mortality being immortal. So another clever piece of writing came into this episode right there.
And so from there, we then cut. So they've had their visit with Ted. You know, he's still in this coma. And then we finally need to check in with Justin. And Justin is at school. He's in class. And he's just sketching away hot the high school jock bods. Daphne's next to him laughing at what he's drawing. The teacher asks Justin a question about, was it about longing or something like that?
Right, right.
And he's describing it. And it's like one of the jocks. And I think this was very subtle where you can see a hint of the jock sort of taking in how Justin is describing what longing and wanting is all about. Mm-hmm. And then the jock like kind of just, you know, shakes it out and acts all bro-y.
Yeah.
and promptly gets detention. And then what I love about how they wrap up this particular scene is that they then cut to Justin, and Justin's like,
Yeah.
He'll be alone.
He's going to be in the equipment room cleaning it because he mouthed off to the teacher.
Right. So
this little scene was interesting where they're cleaning the equipment room.
So Justin joins Chris Hobbs, the jock, in the equipment room. He decides to help him get everything, you know, cleaned up, and they share a soda, and the soda is like, I mean, it's in slow motion as it cracks open.
It was a Pepsi commercial.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny that they're both like sharing it like together. They're both drinking out of the same thing. So
yeah, I'm like, okay, so Chris doesn't have a whole lot of boundaries.
Yeah, no germ phobia or anything.
Yeah, no. And he then starts to describe these other girls at school.
Oh, those girls.
These
girls' names were like from Mean Girls or something. I wrote them down. There was Suzanne Shebly and Mary Frances Cataluto.
It's like, those it's just names. Like they could have been simplified.
Yeah, they're like three part names. And the names didn't even matter, but someplace in some writing room, they went to all the trouble to come up with those names.
Yes. You can imagine that in the writer's room, there had to have been some sort of a track sheet where they're like, here's a first name, here's a middle name, here's a last name. How do we make them work together? You know, I bet that was probably at least 3 or 4 days work right there just to get the names right.
Did you see that, the cute little, Babylon hand stamp that Justin had on?
Yes. Oh my gosh. I love that so much because it was not just the soda can. So it was like Chris opening the soda and handing it to Justin. And as Justin's hand goes forward, we very clearly see the hand stamp of Babylon on there. It was almost like a brand. Like we now understand that Justin, by the way, Justin is gay from that brand.
I have the hand stamp to prove it.
This is like the membership card now.
Yeah.
To the gay club.
Do you think that Chris Hobbs was really angling to get a hand job from Justin? Or do you think that it was supposed to be just kind of incidental that they just start talking about girls and then Chris Hobbs is suddenly like raging hard on?
I think part of me says that I think it was just Chris was horned up because he's a, you know, teenage boy. But I think Justin definitely had motive to want to try and make something happen with this guy.
That was really gutsy too.
Oh my God.
Go like, Justin. Well, yeah. Good for you.
So Chris is like describing like how.
Good for you. It was straight boy.
It was Mary Frances that I think got Chris super hard, but had to leave.
Mary Frances Cataluto.
Yeah. And so, and we see that, you know, Chris is like just rubbing his junk so much. And
he's like all leaning back, his shirt's open, his eyes are closed. He's just kind of like,
and he's just like, and I'm just laying there, and Justin sees it. He's like, You're hard. And like, there's just like a split second of them looking at each other, and then Justin just straight up goes for it. He's like, I'm gonna grab you, now I'm gonna unzip you, and then he just yanks him.
He had a great technique because,
yes, what would you rate that technique?
Well, for Justin, he's very inexperienced, and so I would say that he gets 10 out of 10 for that because that scene literally lasted about 25 seconds, and then Chris Hobbs is all verklempt.
The way it was edited, I think like it was all about, like, they edited to match the climax, if you will.
Well, and the way that it, like, the if we look at it from an acting point of view, if we look at the strokes that Randy Harrison was using as Justin there, he was stroking like something that had to have been like a foot long in there.
Oh, Chris has got to be hung. Dumb jock, super hung, like into it. Good. And I what I love about it is that it's a moment of Justin. I think as part of how he had his coming out moment at Babylon with taking his shirt off and the confetti and let's hear it for the boy, he's owning his sexuality even more. And he's just like, I can give the the high school quarterback a hand job, sure.
Yeah, that was pretty risky of him too, because I think if he would have gotten caught doing that, he would have been in like legal trouble, not just being expelled from his fancy private school.
But obviously worth it.
Meanwhile,
don't worry, we're going to come back to that hand job scene.
We are.
It may just be an offline conversation, but we're going to come back to it.
Yeah, we'll find the trail mix and discuss that scene again. So there's this quick shot, and I don't want to talk too much about this one, but there's a quick shot of like the entire gang in the steam room together after the gym. And I just couldn't help but think that these guys do everything together. And it's part of the story, of course, but is there anything, any boundaries that they don't cross with each other?
No. I really don't think there is, because, I mean, we all know that they've all had some sort of almost sexual experience with each other. So I think that's probably what bonds them. And, you know, I think once you have that click, especially when the show was airing, especially in the early 2000s, that you found that gay click, because those were the people that you could trust. You know, they weren't necessarily as open. Unless you were in like a specific neighborhood or you know.
Right.
So that could be why, is that they knew that they had protection within those group of people.
I thought that Brian Michael and Emmett were weirdly detached from Ted being in a coma and dying. It didn't seem like anybody was like super broken up over it.
They didn't seem worried.
Yeah. Like, it's like they knew the ending.
Like, they're like, it's only the fourth episode. He'll be fine. You know,
probably when they're putting the show together, they probably had their sides from the entire episode. So they knew how it ended. They could have done kind of like the MASH thing where they just didn't tell you that Radar died until, or not Radar died, Henry Blake died until like the very end. And none of the actors knew it until they got the page like 10 minutes before they shot it. But they all just seemed like, yeah, well, he's in a coma, whatever.
Yeah, they were so casual about it. And that was just like, wouldn't any one of you want to be like, I hope Ted is doing okay or whatever? You know, and the casual attitude is going to come back later.
It was kind of underacted in a way, in that, I don't know, if somebody in my close clique of friends had G'd out and was in the hospital in a coma, and the lawyer was talking to somebody about pulling the plug, I don't know is that I would be that kind of matter of fact about it.
After we leave this steam room scene, we're going to, Justin's mother is wanting to spend some time with her son, you know.
What better way than to invite him to Nike Town?
That makes it sound like it's an amusement park.
I'm going to Nike Town. You can drive. It's like, I'm in.
I love the fact that he's so excited to drive when it's like, dude, you're having like some of the hottest gay sex and you're going to the hottest gay club. But driving's what gets you going. Yeah,
jump in the station wagon.
Let's go to Nike Town with mom. That station wagon. What was that? It was like a tourist station wagon? Yeah. Like, wow. And I love
the mother theme comes back here.
Oh, yes. You know, here's another mother who is at a certain phase of dealing with her child's sexuality. And the way she handles it, I thought was like very sweet and very open about it.
It was awkward. It was obviously her first time having that kind of conversation, sure. But she did her best. She kind of brought it out, and Justin flips out.
it may have been like the way she asked it, because she says like, "Do you have a boyfriend, Justin?"
And then the music's like,
and it's like, "Oh shit."
So, do you have a boyfriend, Justin?
You know, you might as well hear the record scratch. And she says, like, it's fine. I won't tell your father. And
she gets a little frantic in her tone. So it's almost like she realized that she just kind of hit a pain point in Justin. And she almost tried to walk it back a little bit and say, no, it's okay.
It'll be fine. But no, he gets out of the car and starts and literally just runs away again. We're going more into the soap opera level now that we have a new director.
Right.
And like, I've never known someone to do that in real life. Like, I'm going to get out of the car and I'm just going to run to wherever.
He's like running right down the middle of the street. And how far away from home could they have been?
So good. Yeah, how far is Nike Town from right. where Justin lives? His beautiful subdivision.
So I think Justin overreacted there. I think that this might have been a little bit of a stumble in the script where it. I think the dramatic tense could have been kept up if he didn't do that, if he stayed in the car and if he was super uncomfortable and if he was kind of white knuckle driving at that point. But I mean, he's just booked.
He's also 17. You know, he's a teenager.
Right. And I would have wanted to see more drama because the dramatic moment was just him running.
It's like, well, and but think right. about what he does. I mean, eventually he runs and we see that he's gotten back to Debbie and Vic and Michael.
Yeah.
You know,
and back to a different mother.
Back to a different mother. A mother that, you know, who has gone through this before, who has proven herself to be incredibly understanding. And and he sort of lays it out with her and with them more than his own mother.
Right.
Which is I thought.
Well, there's not as much at stake for him there when he's talking to Debbie. And when he's talking to his mother, everything's at stake. And it's easy to find the PFLAG mom that you have like nothing to lose by talking to. So that sense of surrogate mother played well right. with the script. Meanwhile, we've got another mother, Ted's mother, talking to Michael in a very cute way, saying, I was going to go to his condo and pick up pajamas for him. And then she drops in, I don't know if he wears them. Well, okay. All of a sudden, Michael, alarm bells are set off in Michael's head, and you see his eyes open up.
And he goes, condo?
Yeah.
He stumbles just the tiniest bit. Like, yeah. you could sort of see the sweat starting to break.
He got more riled up over his mother, or of Ted's mother going back to the condo than he did about Ted being in the coma. But this led into a great scene where they want to protect Ted's mother. So
and so they de-gayify the entire condo. And then we learn a lot more about Ted in this scene. So, of course, we find, I think the first thing they find in the fridge is the poppers.
Poppers.
Nope.
Cheddar.
I don't think there are particularly strong shame issues attached to cheese, Michael.
Fine.
Yeah.
Sure.
And cheese.
And cheese. For some reason, cheese was a trigger for Michael. I'm not sure why.
Cheddar and brie.
I think it must be the brie. If you have anything other than like, you know, craft individual slices, you might have a gay.
It seems like every gay has cheap cheddar in the refrigerator. It's like,
I have cheddar at home.
Really?
I do. the hilarity of this scene grows because it would go from the poppers to the cheese to the multitude of porn, which included a Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks film.
You've Got Mail.
You've Got Mail. That. You've Got Mail.
I love that movie. I really do. The dildos, the 33 dildos. There was great physical acting in this scene where Michael and Emmett are having sword fights with the dildos and throwing them at each other.
Huge. These are huge. And I have many questions for Ted.
Do you think they were used or were they just sort of mantelpieces? Because these are like somebody else's sex toys that they're handling and flipping around. And who does that?
No, well, and that's the thing. Like, first of all, why have 33 dildos?
It was for his birthday. There was one for each year.
Oh.
Of Ted's birthday.
Okay, I must have missed that because nonetheless, that's an alarming number. I would think that after a certain point, you know, you retire one.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he hangs those up in like a display case. You know, after so many years.
After boiling them.
Yeah, this one goes into retirement. We go into the next one. But like some of these were massive dildos.
Would you, if you were in your friend's apartment, would you ever handle his sex toys?
No.
Exactly.
I wouldn't know the state in which they were used.
Michael got hit in the face with one of those.
I would be like going into full Silkwood scrubbing if that happened. No, thank you.
This is where we find that shrine also.
Yes. So they finally, which also it's really funny. The entire time I was expecting during their dildo sword fight that Ted's mother would walk in and they would have to explain why they have this thick, like 12-inch realistic dildo in their hands that they're smacking each other with, like explaining that. But They go into Ted's bedroom and they throw all the dildos back on the bed, and Emmett opens up his armoire or something and sees this collage, and it's all the photos of just Michael.
Yeah, that was it. If you want to suspend disbelief, then you could really enjoy that moment and say, wow, Ted really, really, really likes Michael. But it was just such a shoehorn moment. And the story didn't really go anywhere else. There's a conversation later in the episode, but then it's almost as if this never happened for the rest of the series.
Yeah, they don't deal with it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if I had a close friend who had a shrine to me.
Yeah.
I would have some questions. First of all, where did you get the photos?
Being a photographer.
Well.
And since I did your headshots, Matt, I have probably 200 pictures of you. Thank you. But I don't have them. On the back of a closet door, or the back of an armoire.
Exactly. Ours was completely professional.
Encounter, right.
Completely professional encounter for business.
Yes.
I'm going to sneak this one out. I went back then. They probably had a Kodak film that they could develop.
Yeah, those were prints.
Can you imagine being the guy that's developing those photos?
Yeah, the shirtless picture of Michael to start off with, the one he keeps in his desk. Oui. The cute part about this scene was Michael and Emmett back at the bar where they're talking about it. And Emmett had a really interesting line where they talk about secrets that they have with each other or that they've kept from each other.
There's a lot of things we don't know about each other.
And that didn't make sense to me because this is portrayed as a group of close-knit friends that are spending all of their time together, including in the steam room. And that scene just kind of led us to believe that they're just kind of bar friends almost. And it was a well-acted scene. The writing was good, but it wasn't really the reality that we had seen so far because we know that they are much closer than the way that they're portraying it as, yes, we're friends, but there's an awful lot of secrets that we keep from each other.
Right. Well, I mean, even them discovering that Brian had this almost sexual encounter with Ted and the way it fueled Michael's jealousy. You know, like it was even like, even Ted's had Brian.
Yeah.
And Michael, like, well, and then also I feel like Michael's feelings for Brian are not a well kept secret. Like
yeah.
Everyone's like, you're in love with him. You are never going to get over it. Mm-hmm. And you need to do something about it. You know?
Well, it's not even that. They never say that you should do something about it. And I mean, like Debbie does, and maybe Justin has so far, but
Justin is the only one who's really called him out on it.
Yeah.
Like he's saying that, you know, he, like you're just waiting for him to finish you off. He's jerking you off. And I'm like, I love that it was a 17-year-old high school kid who's like, I'm going to cut through the bullshit of all your other friends and say, this is what's going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, sassy Justin at these early episodes is really, really funny. There's another scene with Brian and Melanie having a cat fight over Ted. And once again, I love Melanie acting up.
Yeah. And she says, yeah, Ted was an idiot for wanting to keep that, but he wanted you. And I think, you know, this episode is probably the one where I was like, this episode was struggling to put Mel and Lindsay into the episode, you know, because they really don't have much drive or stake.
Right.
And what's going on, except for the fact that they know Ted and Mel also happens to be Ted's attorney, apparently.
Yeah.
like, yeah, it just it was a thin connection for me to try and make that happen. But again, it allows us just to watch Brian and Mel go at it.
Yeah.
Which I'm always here for.
And then back in the hospital, Brian's like struggling to pull the plug on Ted. He's either struggling with it or he was about to do it. It was this dramatic scene. Ted's like in his coma and there's Brian almost with his like hand on the button.
Like almost like legitimately, like physically pull a plug.
Yeah.
To end Ted's life. And it's like, he's like, I'm pretty sure that's not a literal phrase.
Yeah. This scene was interesting in that Gail Harold, who played Brian, really didn't have a whole lot of acting experience coming into this and certainly not in episodic TV. And he was so good in that scene with Ted, where he's talking to a dead character, essentially. And he really, really carried that entire scene all by himself. Ted's just laying there. There's just kind of beeps in the background. And I was surprised that an inexperienced actor could really, really carry a scene that well.
And fuck you for choosing me. I'd let you lie here forever. How'd you like that? Can you hear me?
Sometimes they have enough raw talent to carry them through. And speaking of raw talent, we then see, so Brian is going through this internal struggle about what to do with Ted, and enter said orderly, who was previously denied, you know, to Brian.
Mm-hmm.
And they take that time with Ted in coma to just bang in front of him.
Oh, there's an underwear check here.
Underwear check. Patrick?
Brian had on long white boxer briefs.
I will say this. Major step up from the first episode of The Two Exist. White thong that looked fairly used.
We got just a quick look at the orderly. He was wearing cute little gray briefs. And that's all that we saw before Brian jumped on top of him in the bed right next to it. So I think the underwear check here is a split decision for me.
I was a fan of both. I was a fan of both. I love boxer briefs. I'm a big fan of boxer briefs. So,
still?
Yes, I love boxer briefs.
Matt, this is 2017.
You know what? If they can still pull off boxer briefs, then I'm a big fan.
I think anybody can pull those off. Meanwhile.
Meanwhile, so... Brian and the orderly are going at it. We're hearing the noise. We're hearing all of the grunting as the camera slowly pans away. Mm-hmm. Because again, it's still 2000, so we can't show so much gay sex. And we see that Ted moves his head slightly and opens his eyes, and the first words out of his mouth are,
"Jesus."
Yeah.
Because he is watching Brian bang this orderly.
I was looking for something hidden in Brian banging the orderly. Like, what did that actually mean? Was it just a trick, or was there something bigger to it, like a bigger theme going on that is like Lazarus rising from the dead?
I think they wanted something there, but to me, it really just read like, oh, there's just another conquest, because remember, Brian is very sexual. You know, I don't think there was a lot for me to make that connection to something more meaningful the way the other things in the episode have played out, like with the three mothers. Here, it was literally just another trick. Nothing else to it for me.
I almost wish that the trick would have been fake. Like, it was all in Brian's imagination, and then that's what woke up
Ted.
That would have been
nice.
Yeah. But I think the series is a little too young to be throwing that kind of witchcraft into it, though.
So now we know that Ted is awake. He's alive, because remember, it's only episode 4. So,
right. He came back to life within one episode. I mean, come on. Could have at least stretched this out. I'm going to use up my last UK chip here.
This is number 3.
In the UK version, they killed him. He never woke up.
Spoiler alert.
So, meanwhile... We do a lot of meanwhiles here because everybody's jumping around in their own life and they...
Yeah, there's a lot of cuts to and from.
Yeah.
You get back, you know, a lot of parallel storylines happening in this show.
We finally get to see Vic in a really, really cute comedic sense where Debbie and Justin are having a conversation and Vic just keeps jumping into it every few minutes with something really, really funny about... It's both funny and like a little bit of creepy old man about Justin.
But you know, what's nice about having Vic as a character, especially for someone like Justin, is that he is of that generation that wasn't meant to survive. Like, that's what we know of Vic. And
well, there's that line where Justin is saying, "I'm going to run away to New York and be a go-go boy and let gross old homos."
No, he was going to be a hustler. Yeah, hustler and have gross old man. And Vic, without skipping a beat, is like, $20 or something like that.
I'll give you $20.
And I was like, Vic, You dog.
I'll go to New York. I'll become a hustler and I'll sell my body to gross old homos.
I'll give you $20.
Yeah. He had that other line where he's talking about being seen with Justin would be a little too much like Fagin and Oliver Twist.
And if I go, it looks a little Fagin and Oliver Twist.
It's such a funny reference, and it's something that I think many people would get.
Well, I think for Vic, it would have been, you know, Fagin and Oliver, you know, like the musical.
Yeah. And then there's Vic comes back with that line in a little bit of downtime, and he just says,
"What are you studying in school?"
Hmm?
Called conversation.
That doesn't help Vic's case of being creepy, being a creepy old man. Hi, I'll give you $20 to do things to me. By the way, what are you studying in school?
Yeah. I actually saw Jack Weatherall played Vic, and I actually saw him at the gym once in Chicago. He was doing a play here, and he was just ripped at the time. So he was well made up to play Vic, and he just kind of like melted himself into it. And he's mostly a stage actor, and so his timing with Justin and interjecting with Debbie was really, really, really good. I liked it.
Then after we have this conversation, Brian busts in very casually announces, "Oh, Ted's awake."
Yeah.
It's like...
Well, he was there to pick up Justin, right?
Right, yeah. He was there for Justin. And then again, casually, Justin mentions, "Oh, yeah, Ted's awake." And, you know, and just that, again, feeds into the casual nature of the entire episode that they have towards Ted being in a coma.
Right.
They're just, it's like almost like they can't be bothered. It's just so cavalier the way they handle it. And Brian and Justin have sex in Michael's room. Like, that is just a big fuck you to Michael to me.
Did they actually fuck, or was that?
Oh, no, well, Justin at least blew him.
Yeah.
But that at least happened.
Yeah.
But I'm just like... So I'm like, it's as if Justin is like playing out the fantasy that Michael's always wanted,
mm-hmm.
like to, so he could get finished off. And I'm just like, oh, that's cold.
Those were great cuts between the scene upstairs and then Michael downstairs at the kitchen table. He's just looking more and more frustrated. And you can see that he's just kind of simmering and it's starting to come to a mm-hmm. boil. And then they come back downstairs. And I love this cute little look that Justin gave to Michael, which was, yep.
I got it.
And Michael was just so annoyed by it.
That's fair. I think Michael has like, what, 15 years of blue balls with Brian? Like, I think that's a totally fair assessment.
So Debbie is going to deliver Justin back to his house. And so brings Michael as kind of a prop. And they're in the front seat and they've got Justin in the back seat. So They're talking in the front seat, and the whole time you can just see Justin's cocky smile still coming from the back seat about all things Michael, because mm-hmm. he knows exactly what Michael wants, and he's getting it, and Michael's not, and he knows that Michael has always been kind of a jackass to him, and he's winning, and it's that little cocky winning smile that carried that scene in the car.
I'm amazed that Michael, like, continue, like, even though he, like, always tries to say, like, I'm not dealing with the kid anymore. I'm not doing, it's like, but you're still going to do it. And yeah. It's like,
The scene on the porch with the mothers, we have two of our three hero mothers come together on this porch scene.
And I loved this scene. I really, really did, because it's as, you know, Debbie is trying to make it a teaching moment for Jennifer. Yeah. And, you know, saying like this, if you think of it this way rather than this way, if you don't make it a question, just as they, you know, this yeah. is what he is, it's going to make things so much easier. I love that she's like trying to be of a comfort and trying to offer some sage advice, because clearly she's gone through this.
Mm-hmm.
But we hear in the background, we hear Justin's dad.
Right.
And it's like, you can sense like that's not.
Yeah. She steps out on the porch. She closes the door a little bit. And Sharon Glass was really giving those lines well, because it didn't come across as preachy. They came across as real. And I think that's why that scene works so well, is those lines very easily could have been just very technical, and they didn't come across that way. You really believed what she was saying.
Oh yeah, I was big fan of that scene.
So then there was that final scene with Ted's mother, and we never ever see her again. She never pops back up.
This is sort of the end of Ted's mother.
So we go from our three hero mothers down. We're down one mother, so we've only got two left. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that scene was for, where Ted and his mother are talking, but it's just gone. It went nowhere.
Yeah, it just sort of sputtered. It's like, I'm sorry, but this should be like a life changing thing for Ted.
Yeah.
Having almost died.
Yeah, and suddenly he's like 100% back to normal. I don't know how long they kept him in the hospital, right? But he was out of his coma and just about ready to go again.
Yeah, and we'll see you at Babylon. Yeah.
Did you get that line that Emmett said? The Oscars immediately preceded by the Barbara Walters special. I didn't understand that line at all.
Oh, there was, for the longest time, like it was like a 2020 thing, and Barbara Walters, she would interview people who were nominated for Oscars in any given, in whatever year. I think that's what the reference is. I mean, but yeah, I mean, that's a very like a 2000 of its time reference.
Right. The episode ends, at Babylon with Michael and Brian dancing, and Brian tells him, I want you to be the one about pulling the plug. And it just ended with this corny line where you can pull my plug, or however that went. It was
and this
just
is where
corny.
I'm just banging my head on the desk.
Yeah.
It's just, once again, Brian stringing Michael along. Mm-hmm. And it's also just an odd place to ask for such a thing, and
right,
yeah,
more trail mix involved probably. So our conclusion of this episode, does it hold up or not? This episode was a little bit of an island in my view. There was a lot of stuff that didn't really go anywhere or didn't really set us up for anything else, but more or less I think it held up. My biggest complaint is how short the Ted story was. He was literally in a coma for 40 minutes or so of right? screen time, and everything was put back into place in that episode.
There were, I'm going to say I wasn't a huge fan, especially considering the craziness that was going on in the previous episode. I wanted more dramatic stakes.
We had fun like with it was, that, I mean, last
episode. That was one hell of a cliffhanger they left us with.
Yeah.
And to then just like, he's in a coma. We'll get to it when we get to it. This episode was not great in the follow through. I think it had a great setup from the previous episode, but the follow through was not there for me.
I wonder how much of this has to do with like different writers on this episode.
Right, because this is the time where we have now gotten a new director, mm-hmm. new writers, people who were not completely involved with the UK version. I'm allowed one too. So, so I'll take that one for Patrick. Is this, correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, is this the point where we start to see a departure from the UK version,
or do we? Yeah. The main storylines start to go their own direction. There's a few nods to the UK version, but this ends up being kind of the end of that first hour and a half episode of the UK version. There's only four episodes in the UK, so they were crammed into, I think, maybe 3.5 hours total.
Well, that explains why they could kill off Ted, because they were.
Yeah, his name was Phil.
Or Phil in the UK version.
Yeah,
here it's like, well, we don't know how long this show is gonna go, so we got to keep him alive. So let's like dangle him in a little bit of danger, but don't worry, he'll be back next week.
Yeah. So next time we'll be talking about Now Approaching the Line. We'll see you then.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.